The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
A very warm welcome to all of you to another live session at Best Ideas 2018. We've had a truly terrific day so far, several great live sessions and also sessions we've recorded in recent days that are now available in the online conference area on moiglobal.com. It gives me special pleasure to introduce our next instructor, somebody who is truly very well known to everyone in the MOI Global membership community. We appreciate Bob Robotti as a mentor and someone who has made a great contribution to our community. We've learned a tremendous amount from Bob over the years, and always appreciate his wisdom and ideas. Bob has also been a speaker at our Latticework event, and I look forward to personally welcoming Bob at Idea Week very soon as well. Just by way of background, as you know, Bob is the founder, president, and chief investment officer of Robotti & Company, based in New York City. Guided by the classic tenets of value investing, Robotti & Company uses a proprietary research approach to identify companies with solid balance sheets and the ability to generate significant amount of free cash flow, and yet companies that are misunderstood, neglected, or simply out of favor. Before founding the firm in 1983, Bob was CFO of Gabelli & Company. Joining Bob for this session is David Kessler, who joined Robotti & Company in 2009 and has also been someone I've enjoyed getting to know and is another terrific contributor to the MOI Global community. And so I am very excited to turn the floor now over to Bob and David for their presentation. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you all for joining. I do love being called a mentor because that's a very nice way of saying I'm an old guy. So I like mentor much better than that. Thanks a lot. So actually, I'm going to have David start off and kind of give you an overview of the firm's investment philosophy and approach. So David, if you kind of pick that up.
Sure. Good afternoon. And hopefully in speaking about that, it'll also give you some background into the idea that Bob's going to speak to today. If you've heard us speak before, this is the one slide that always remains the same, and that's because our investment philosophy has remained consistent. And we believe that in order to outperform the market, you have to have one of three edges: an analytical edge, where you've analyzed the data in a way that the other market hasn't arrived at the conclusion that you've come to yet; an informational edge, where you've been able to accumulate legal information and piece it together in a way that others have not arrived at yet; or a behavioral edge, where you're able to control your emotions and take a long-term differentiated view. Now, what we believe at Robotti, our advantage is that for all of our investments, we have achieved either an analytical or an informational edge, but only because of the behavioral edge that we use as a lens to view everything else. And because we're viewing everything through really a longer term 5 to 10 year time horizon, we're looking at different data and different information and able to piece it together in different ways. Now, Jean-Marie Evillard, who was a famous value investor who ran the first Siegel Fund, described value investing as being a big tent with Graham and Dodd on one end, Warren Buffett on the other. But I think that there is one element that all successful investors, and actually value or investors who have had success with other styles, have in common, and that is that they're all contrarian. Now, and that contrarian skill or contrarian mindset can also be extrapolated onto the management of the companies that we're looking to invest in, and that's something that Bob will speak to today. Now, when I had my value awakening, one of the first books I read was Bruce Greenwald's Value Investing, and at Columbia, he continues to carry on a tradition of value investing, where he always talks about looking for cheap, boring, and ugly stocks. But 10 years later, it seems like boring and ugly has become the old school of value investing, and it's been replaced by looking for more glamorous, quote unquote, compounders. And while we're certainly not opposed to finding cheap compounders, we found that the most opportune time to invest in them is before everyone else recognizes that they're compounders. Now today, Bob's gonna talk about an idea that we consider to be run by a true outsider, to use modern terms. The company, it's an asset-intensive business. It operates in a highly cyclical industry, and it's tied heavily to commodity, in this case, energy prices. And in, just in case you haven't closed your browser yet to wait for the next section, the company also has no clear timeline or catalyst. Cheap, boring, and ugly. But why at Rabadi & Company do we often see value in cheap, boring, ugly, and often cyclical companies? And by investing those, have produced a record that we're proud of over 30 years. The answer lies in understanding the value of economic cycles. Now, there was a book that I recently read called Capital Returns. It's a compilation of letters by Marathon Partners put together by Edward Chancellor. And the book describes what they call the economic cycle. And I'll describe it by using a recent example of the US housing industry. We see new entrants attracted by prospects of high returns. Starting in 2002, we saw home prices rise dramatically up through when they started to fall in the end of 2006. As we saw more capital rush into the industry, lenders lowered rates and bent over backwards to make loans, lowering standards to make a profit. At the time the bubble peaked in 2006, the excess stock of new homes was equal to 5 times the annual production required to satisfy new household formations. And so we saw very quickly the bubble burst. The time that we've entered since that is often a cathartic process where we have industries or we have businesses that shed assets, competition falls to the wayside, and so the survivors come out with improved earnings power, and we enter what is often a new cycle. Now, if you have a basic understanding of economics and you listen to that example, that seems like common sense. So why don't more investors invest in cyclical industries instead of shying away from them? And I think the answer lies in what Charlie Munger says about Berkshire's investment style, is that it's simple, but not easy. Now, there's many reasons for why this capital cycle exists. Managers are often become overconfident going into the cycle. They spend capital to increase assets, not with often ignoring or neglecting the competition. They also have an inside view where they are only surrounded by what they're seeing and extrapolate the recent performance into what they believe is going to happen in the future. And then you have skewed incentives where oftentimes management is incentivized to grow for growth's sake. And then you'll have bankers and other investors who are also pushing sometimes for the wrong incentives. But I think that what is one of the reasons that people often shy away from that type of investing is that I think in order to be able to spot the situations where these type of opportunities exist and to spot the companies that are going to exit the cycles as the winners takes experience. And there's no shortcut for experience. Unfortunately, it takes time. And I'll leave with just a quick story that Charles Fabricant, who happens to be the chairman of the company that Bob will present in a moment, said in a speech he once gave. And he talked about a journalist who was interviewing an extremely successful investor in the boat business. And the interviewer began by asking his subject what accounted for his successful career in such a highly volatile business. Now, the reporter expected the investor to launch into a discussion of his career, but what he found was he was met with silence for several minutes and finally got a response, good decisions. The reporter waited for the investor to expand on that, but he didn't. So he tried to explain to the investor that he was going to have to write a story on this, so maybe you could explain how you reach good decisions. Again, after a long silence, the investor looked up and said, experience. The reporter was becoming frustrated, knowing he needed more than those few words, and so he asked, how did you come by that experience that helped you make good decisions? And without hesitation, the investor said, bad decisions. So with that, I'll hand it over to Bob, who has probably made bad decisions long before I met him, but we're lucky enough to learn from those now.
Which way did I went the wrong way? So the company I want to talk to you about today is Seacor Marine. It was spun off from Seacor Holdings back in June of last year. It's a fleet of vessels that are highly specialized. The stock trades at less than 50% of book, and that's an interesting entry point for us. But of course, we know that trading at less than book is not necessarily a formula for immediate success or even long-term success. There's other things that need to be in place. And we think that a key component is that the management and the, including both operationally and capital allocation here, is extremely experienced, has a great record, and an important component. So operationally, extremely strong. Capital allocation, Charles Fabricant, you know, has a very significant positive long-term record on that. It's a I apologize because it actually is a $233 million market cap company, therefore it's a micro cap. But I guess that's part of what comes along with investing in cyclical businesses. Small cap companies become micros, mid cap companies become small cap, so they all get smaller in the downturn. So therefore, you know, it's an attribute of that investment process. The company itself, as I mentioned, was spun off back in June. It was, when it was part of the company, if you go back to 2013, 2014, a significant portion of the revenues in the cash flow of the business. Since the spinoff, it's traded down for a number of different reasons, because you do see, of course, at the chart we have here, oil price has been going up over that period of time, but the stock has traded down. And including shortly after spinoff, I also have an investment in a company somewhat in the industry, and that's Tidewater, a very big position. People called me up and said, gee, this thing's trading at 75% of book. Tidewater's trading at 25% of book. Seems like a short Seacor Marine and go long. It's a great paired trade. And so there's a lot of pressures that really have kind of got on the stock since it's publicly trading and on its own. Of course, I would point out one of the differences between this company trading at 50% of book and Tidewater today trading at 25% of book is that this is run by a capital allocator who's got a great record of understanding capital allocation and good success, as opposed to Tidewater, we're still run by the same management that bankrupted a company that lost $3 billion for shareholders. So there is a difference between them. The company itself, what they do is they have vessels that really support offshore marine activity, a lot of it in the oil and gas business. This is their slide talking about the business is distinctive and non-commoditized. I think they're being a little bit liberal with their definitions. You know, there's some commoditization. It isn't as commoditized as certain other points, because you do have a list on the side of the fleet attributes, and they have these fast boat business, a lift boat business, a standby safety business, a wind farm maintenance business, so therefore significant portions that aren't directly related to the oil and gas business. The chart here really talks about vessel supply and kind of the current picture. It's a very fragmented industry with many different players, therefore providing opportunities for acquisitions, both small and large. So in this opportune time with difficult cash flows, a company like Seacor is out looking to help consolidate the business and can make small acquisitions that help move the meter, but also larger ones too can be contemplated. An important component to the business is that it really is very much not like Tidewater, Gulfmark, the other offshore oil service businesses, because a lot of little niche businesses, because even though there's some generalities and commonalities, there's a lot of difference between the flag state, the location, the geography it works in, the size of the vessels, the design, and therefore different niches. And so, and Seacor has really done a great job of identifying small niches, whether that's the offshore lift boat business in the Gulf of Mexico, whether it's the oil service business with a joint venture partner in Mexico, whether that's the utility wind farm business in the North Sea. So niche little businesses that help with some differentiation moderating the cash flows, capital cycles. So David talked about good decisions come from experience and experience comes from bad decisions. And so here's a long-term history of oil. And I guess I was first an investor in the oil business back in the early 70s, and therefore, you know, have a, I think, a really good history of kind of what that business is like, how oil prices drive a lot of activity and drive investment opportunity and also investment losses, so, you know, how to take advantage of that cycle. One of the things I would point out on this is that frequently in the current downturn in the energy business, oil markets recently, a lot of people have said this is the worst ever. This is worse than it was in the 80s. They make a lot of comments like that. And all I keep thinking is either they have forgotten because they're as old as me and the memories aren't as good, or they weren't around to therefore experience. So, you know, in the 70s period where oil prices went from flatlining for decades at 20 and spiked to, you know, significantly over that, and had two events, right? But what you really ended up in the 80s was a huge oversupply. So from 1982 to 1986 is probably the bottom. All you had was oil going down and down. And what really drove that was you had a world that consumed 58 million barrels a day that would had the ability to produce 72 million barrels a day. So you had a 20% oversupply. So when someone says, oh, the current downturn is like the 80s, I don't see how anybody can take a 20% oversupply and compare it to 2 million barrels on a 94 million base, which seems to me is almost the margin of safety that you need, given the uncertainty in certain countries that produce oil, that you need as a safety valve to kind of moderate what it is. So I do think that that analogy is a really bad one, and therefore people make, I think, poor decisions from it. Here's a chart. The offshore oil boat business is really in large part servicing the offshore rig business. So this is an important leading indicator of where the business outlook looks like. And what you can see is, of course, from 06 through the 14, the number went up pretty consistently and therefore drove an increase in the boat demand. And of course, starting in 14, interestingly, I would point out, it's the beginning of 2014 when rig activity offshore started to decline. So that's got to be 5, 6, 10 months before the oil price break that actually happens, you know, in Thanksgiving of 2014. And what really had happened was the costs had risen to the level that even at $90 oil, much of the offshore activity was not economic. And so that what's really began the decline in the business was that economic reality. Of course, the drop in the price of oil clearly exacerbated that problem. We'd also point out that, you know, over the last year, what you've really seen is a stabilization in the offshore activity. And so therefore, that also is obviously important for boat utilization. And importantly, back to that cycle of long time on oil and gas, you know, there's a strong conviction we have that the fundamentals are in place for continued improvement in price, and even stability at these levels is going to drive significantly higher activity. So in response to the offshore drilling activity, that's what happens to the boat business, right? There's a ramp up in the building of new boats to therefore service the demand. You see that pre the financial crisis, well, it's actually, you see, and this chart shows the deliveries post the financial crisis. So they're 9, 10, 11, but those are all boats that were started to be built before the crisis happened. So commitments are being delivered post the crisis. And of course, you've seen a significant decline in really the new deliveries have evaporated, gone away. So therefore, the supply side of it is no longer swamping the problem. What this chart shows is the relationship between the number of boats and the number of rigs. And back in 08, there were about three boats for every rig, which is about what you need normally for every rig that operates. It probably needs three boats servicing its needs, going back and forth to shore, bringing equipment and supplies. And so you probably had full utilization. That's what drove the increase in activity and building new equipment. And of course, today what you really have is significant oversupply because the rig count has fallen so much and all of those vessels have been delivered. So that sets you up. And, you know, Seacorp Marine is not exempt from that. What you see in this chart is of, you know, the day rate revenues come down to half of where it was kind of before the decline in the cycle. What that means is, given the operating leverage of the business, that means it's gone from generating really good free cash flows to generating really no free cash flows. And in certain cases, probably even negative cash flows. So what happened about starting 2 years ago, so November of 2015, a number of capital providers identified the business and said, this is an interesting cycle that's repeated itself, and therefore there's an opportunity for us to buy assets at a significant discount to what their intrinsic value is, the replacement value, the earnings power of those businesses. The first one was actually C-Corp itself. In November of 2015, it entered into an agreement with Carlyle Group to provide capital, $175 million, they put up in the form of a convertible note. So the company got seven-year cash to be able to invest with low interest rate, and potentially getting Carlyle as an investor look for other opportunities to consolidate the business, since they thought there was a great consolidation opportunity. C-Corp and Carlyle were not the only ones thinking there's a great opportunity to buy assets discounted at the bottom of a cycle. You also had Christian Siem, who we know well through our investments in Subsea 7, who we think is a great capital allocator with a great record also, partnering with Elliott Management to identify and buy vessels in the North Sea. More recently, Gulfmark's recapitalized the balance sheet, as did Tidewater, I mentioned. And they're both interesting companies in that they're really debt-free companies today. And you know, the assets are heavily discounted from what the book value was pre the restructuring. And so I think you can buy assets there at a quarter of book with companies that have a balance sheet that gives them clear survivability. But in the process, in Gulfmark, both C-Corp and Subsea 7, C-Corp and Carlyle made a bid to recap Gulfmark. In the process, what you also had was Mike Price and Mutual Shares made a bid to buy it. So there's definitely a lot of smart capital that was interested in being in the boat business. You did not see attrition, of course, over the last few years, definitely in the 13, 14, 15 period of time, because activity was still strong. And even old boats that really were not competitive continued to work, given the demands of the business. So what you have seen, of course, more recently is the supply is beginning to have attrition. But that said, there's no quick attrition for the fleet. The problem with it is that boats themselves don't have much steel value, so therefore the scrap value is relatively minimal. So what you've really gotten is a lot of the fleet is really tied up in cold stack position, where you can maintain a boat for $800 a month. And so therefore you can defer making a decision to scrap it without much value expected at scrapping time. So we think that's an important component, and therefore the beginning of the supply reduction is happening. So you'll have two things. One is the vessels that are in tie up. You know, do they ever come out of tie up? A lot of them won't. Effectively, they'll be scrapped by being tied up. And at the same time, they also see more bifurcation between the vessels themselves in terms of the capacity and capability. So the older ones also will not return to service. So therefore, I think the supply side of the equation has begun a significant corrective process. what you've seen is, in recent times, a stabilization in terms of the activity. So therefore, vessels being taken out of service has gotten to the point where it's actually ticked up slightly in recent periods of time. So this last year, again, with rig activity picking up some, there's an increased boat activity, and there would appear on the horizon to be a significant increase in offshore activity, which should drive. And in certain markets, you've already seen a significantly larger demand for supply of vessels that is out there. Here's a chart that this goes over the size of the fleet, and again highlights how many are over 25 years old, how many are over 15 years old. So it's not only an age issue, it's also the design of the vessel, its competitiveness in the marketplace today. So there's again going to be that bifurcation where that will accelerate kind of really what the competitive fleet is. So as the demand side starts to correct, the supply side more quickly will come into balance than might appear to be the case with 3,500 vessel count. This chart just highlights the fact that, you know, the oil and gas business is an extremely capital intensive, long cycle business, and therefore the replacement of reserves is dramatically and continuously declined. That goes back to even 2012. So inevitably that will have an impact on a go forward basis. Here in C-Corp itself, we talk about the company, and this is kind of a long history of kind of what they've done, their entry into the business, how at various times they've been an acquirer, they've bought assets, at other times they've monetized and therefore sold assets. So one of the highlights we would have about C-Corp Marine is not a marine business that, like many businesses, love the business they're in and always want to grow. This is a business that's really focused on getting returns on capital, and therefore being both a buyer at the right time and a seller at the right time. So therefore, the monetization is an important component of kind of why we think C-Corp Marine is differentiated from other competitors in its space. here's a chart where the company highlights an important component, and that is since 1975, they've actually sold 500 vessels. So normally, yes, people will tell you they bought 500 vessels, but they're not going to sell them. So there's a constant realization of that fact. John Gellert, who's actually the CEO of the company, has been with the company for 25 years, and he's run the company since 2003. So, significant.
And I think it's important to point out that Charles Fabrikant has a record. He started Secor in 1989, has a tremendous record of buying and selling assets at the right time, and most importantly, thinking like an intelligent investor.
Thank you, Dave. Here's a chart that does highlight the strategic plans of each of the two companies. That is Secor Holding, the parent company that spun it off, which when we were preparing for this, we actually thought about presenting it as an idea too, because the common attribute between the two is what you have is Charles Fabrikant, who's allocating capital, who thinks about the entry of businesses at opportune times when the assets are available at a significant discount to what their economic value is, and then we'll monetize them when there's excitement about these cyclical businesses. I guess one of the comments in the Secor Holdings, one of the next to last bullet point down, is they harvest gains, they don't hug assets. So therefore, it's an important differentiator, we think, between many capital-intensive, asset-intensive businesses. In addition to being able to buy through acquisition, at the low points in the cycle, the company has CapEx plans, has spent money, continues to spend money on new vessel buildings, because there is an opportunity to build value in organic ways too, even in low points in the cycle. The cost to construct equipment becomes extremely attractive. The ability to kind of defer that is, one of the aspects that minimizes some of the capital requirements. The idea that, in the fast boat business, which is 50% of their assets is in this fast boat business, which is a new budding business, which is really displacing the offshore helicopter business. He built a number of vessels and committed to build them based on environmental rules and changes and grandfathering and the position he had. So he's going to have the newest vessel that's going to have by far the lowest cost, that therefore is competitively advantaged in the marketplace. Here's a chart that really gives a good sense of the fact that this is not an offshore boat company like Tidewater and like Gulfmark. It really is a number of aggregated specialized businesses that play in different parts of the cycle of oil and gas, but even not in oil and gas. The second from the bottom, the wind farm utility business, that's a business in which it really is the maintenance of offshore wind farms in the North Sea. So a business that has continuity and consistency to it. So it's a very different business that isn't driven by the oil and gas business, right? And, the offshore wind farm business continues to grow, and therefore that universe gets greater over time. And as I mentioned, this fast boat business, it really is a displacement that is much more cost effective to ferrying employees back and forth to offshore equipment versus helicopters, which are a much more expensive option. And yet the fast boats have all kinds of the comforts to them and designs to them and internet access. And so therefore, from an employee point of view, a 4-hour boat ride versus a 45-minute helicopter ride, they talk about the wrench time differential between that is only 45 minutes. So you're paying half the price, and yet you're losing very little of the employee time in terms of actually productive man hours. So, an interesting thing. The lift boat business is also, a very differentiated little business that is actually going through tough times today, but they're in the process of acquiring a joint venture through the bankruptcy process. And again, Charles is somebody who is very familiar with bankruptcies, as knows how to work and maneuver around, and therefore use that as an available tool to acquire companies and assets at significant discounts. Here's the debt maturity schedule. Of course, the most significant portion of the debt is the convertible notes from Carlyle, which aren't due through 2022. A modest interest rate with a maturity that, and of course, no covenant restrictions. So therefore, even in the downturn here, not an issue in terms of difficult times potentially causing acceleration of debt and lender discomfort. Here's a chart that we think highlights the potential opportunity. So, and that is back in 2013, you see that the vessel operating profit of the business was $214 million. Since then, actually, the vessel fleet is probably larger than that. So we're not necessarily suggesting that pricing is getting back to 2013 anytime soon, but we do think that, somewhere three, four years down the road, it has that potential. In the meantime, they'll continue to look for and acquire assets you know, significant discounts, and therefore add further to the earnings power of the business. Here's a chart that breaks down the book value associated with the hard assets he has. And as you see, this fast vessel support business is 50% of the assets. The book value itself, you know, we point out, you know, is not only a depreciated book value, but also in recent years, given the difficulty of the business, there's been a number of impairments that he's taken down and written the book value down even further. You know, we would think that some of those impairments, the subsequent events and the change in the business potentially means that those were probably more aggressive than what the earnings power of the assets are. So it's not just 50% of book. We think it's a much larger discount to what the real economic value, clearly what the replacement value of these assets are. And therefore, we think eventually the long-term earnings power, because that's what we do think, replacement value is relevant over time when you get balance in supply and demand. And we think that the supply attrition and the demand growth over the next couple of years leads to a point where you probably have that. Let me go back to this. In addition, it's not just that. So, for example, even where you are today, the number of vessels operating is probably close to the fleet that's not tied up. So we already have in the North Sea activity that there is new rig activity that doesn't have corresponding offshore boat activity, that therefore there's demands for incremental offshore boats. Since the fleet is fully employed of what's at work, that means you have to bring something out of layup. Bringing out a layup is anywhere from a $400,000 to a $1.5 million expense per vessel. And anyone bringing a vessel out is going to be able to, A, command a higher rate for that because of the demand and need for it, and then also probably be able to get contract terms that also means that over the contract they'll be able to pay back the investment they'll bring. So you already see, we think, an inflection in pricing starting to happen. And, of course, once that happens to that incremental tonnage that comes back out into service, we think it actually means that it will work its way through to the rest of the fleet. And therefore, you see improving pricing, improving margins, and all of those advantages that kind of come from it. So that's one of the things you see. One of the things we also talk about is, you know, their ability to buy assets. So recently they've made a small acquisition where they bought four vessels and they paid somewhere between $7 to $9 million. You take $9 million, the high end of that range is $2.25 million is what they paid for each vessel. Those vessels were probably constructed in 2010 for about $6 million a vessel. So therefore he's buying those things for a third of what they were constructed for. And they are, you know, in a class and at a work level that, you know, is extremely competitive in the current market. So therefore, should be able to generate returns that tie back to an unlevered rate of return for that original cost. So not only can you buy, of course, that's what his real intent is, to try to buy those assets from others at a fraction of what their economic value is. But there's also the opportunity, because if you build those vessels anew today, it probably would cost $17 to $18 million. So an organic new build opportunity, given the fleet, the shipyard distress, the willingness for them to negotiate, for them to sell it to you at cost or even less than cost, means that, you know, you can buy it at a 30% discount. So organic opportunities exist as well as asset acquisitions. And a four-boat acquisition for Tidewater doesn't move the meter, but for Secor, a number of those put together really do have the potential. So, you know, they're a competitor, and because of their small size, can do smaller acquisitions as well as larger acquisitions. The larger acquisitions are largely predicated on, you know, will Carlyle have an interest? And we will observe that, you know, yes, there was a lot of institutional interest in this business in the beginning of 16, when people thought there was the opportunity that I can buy assets at a distressed value. And of course, we know that the world is awash with capital today, and the idea that you could invest in something at a fraction of what the assets are. And of course, many people did that in the onshore business. Bought, so a particular deal that we are close to is Cerberus bought the pressure pumping assets of a Canadian company for 30% of book, and, you know, recently a year ago took it public at 2x book. So therefore, you know, in less than a year's time had a 6x return on gain, because suddenly the market understood and saw that the assets really were going to be in demand again, and therefore started to price that forward. So even though the bloom is off the rose right now, and Carlyle's interest is probably abated, and Elliott has kind of gone away, and Siem hasn't been able to buy boats, and so therefore there's been, you know, a subsiding of that institutional interest. We do think the fundamentals, as they start to turn over the next 3 months, 6 months, potentially awaken those animal spirits. And we know that the equity, private equity market is awash in capital, and therefore the opportunity to buy an asset at a third of what it's worth, you know, could real easily rekindle that interest. And so we think that that's part of the component that could accelerate the timeline in terms of a recovery. One of the risks to investment, they're multiple. Obviously, oil price, and you know, there's plenty of reasons why it could go down, even though we think the fundamentals underlying it, as we said, capital intensive business with 3-4 years of significant underinvestment, the projects that were committed to back then are all online. Therefore, there's a dearth of new things that kind of come online from here. The realization of the real economics of onshore production being significantly higher than what people thought a year ago. So there's a number of movers that we have pretty strong conviction that oil price strength recently has, there's plenty of underlying fundamentals to it. Ship owners themselves will delay. Now, the delaying of the scrapping, we actually think is is minimized here, because the longer the vessel stays in layup, the less likelihood it comes out. So, you know, it's attrition kind of on the vine. And so there's an argument that the longer it takes, the recovery will be stronger, because more vessels will be gone from the fleet. So the supply side continues to accelerate its correction. And therefore, you know, that's really less of an issue, we think. Obviously, there's always liquidity issues. And even though the balance sheet and the cash position is strong today, you know, continual operations, you know, could over the next two, three, expose the company to in some ways there. And then here's just some disclosures about us and the firm.
Yeah.
That's the disclaimer, and we'll open to questions.
Well, Bob and David, thank you so much for such a comprehensive and compelling presentation. A reminder to all of you on the line, if you have a question, feel free to type it into the online interface now. As we compile the queue, perhaps a question on capital allocation, Bob, and whether you would like to see management prioritize anything differently than they are doing now?
No, you know, the advantages that, you know, of investing in a business that you have high conviction that the management is aligned in thinking about shareholder value and how to create shareholder value, you know, the management's knowledge of the business is clearly superior to mine. So understanding the particulars of Mexico and what the opportunity is there and the JV they have with the local party that therefore gives them a local flagging and therefore competitive advantage in that marketplace, the potential growth in what Mexico looks like in terms of, right, you have this artificial line, arbitrary line drawn in the Gulf of Mexico between what's the U.S. waters and what's the Mexican waters. And on one side of it, you have significant oil and gas activity. And you would think that the geology and world's how oil and gas has laid down didn't stop at that arbitrary line, but clearly like flows over the line. So the opportunity in terms of that marketplace, you know, is significant and identifiable. Pemex still has issues in terms of getting the opportunities open to others, but they have done that too. They've let people come in. So, you know, Mexico is an interesting opportunity, but even that, the particulars of the JV and how it works and vessels they move into it, there's Charles is a master of the details, you know, because the devil's in the details, and he is a devil in the detail kind of guy. You know, a number of the things that he'll do is, you know, the restructuring of the lift boat business that he's buying out of bankruptcy. You know, he's got an entity he's going to recapitalize. He's going to put vessels in it, put them at risk. But what he also has is the debt that's in it is non-recourse to the parent company. So, again, he's got investments that he's making. The risk reward of those he's limiting because he's not going to, if he's wrong on it, you know, subject the company to that risk. So there's a lot of particulars, and it's also how he structures deals that are also important components on how he's going to drive value over time. And, you know, that he's got 50 years of experience. He's an experienced attorney. You know, he understands the nuances, the particulars of the business, the Jones Act foreign flag, how that works. There's, you know, all these particulars that, and of course, his business itself in C-Corp Holdings, you know, he's in business in Uruguay. He's been in business in Venezuela. So he's been in odd places that he's thought about and, you know, has figured out how to venture in on a low risk, risk adjusted. How do I have significant upsides? How do I moderate my risk on the entry point? So he's a very capable, experienced manager.
I want to go to the line of Shai Dardashti to take us through the queue.
Hi, Bob. Do you hear me?
Yep, I can. Wonderful.
I'm seeing a question from a Latticework Summit participant, which I think is particularly spot on. Let me read it verbatim, if I may.
Sure.
Thank you for this wonderful presentation. You stated that there is a sentiment for offshore activity. You covered many aspects of this industry and the company. Would you be so kind to spend some extra time on the specific competitive advantages of this company and or the competitive landscape? What makes a winner in this industry?
An important component in a capital-intensive cyclical business is understanding capital allocation. When to allocate capital, what's the right price, how to do it, and how to do it intelligently. And so that's the things that's driving me here. So, you know, I did mention Tidewater is kind of in the same general area. And, you know, I do also own Tidewater, but I think it's a different investment thesis. There, I think I'm buying assets even at a larger discount to what they're worth. The recap balance sheet gives it kind of longevity that I think, you know, clearly has staying power to last through whatever this downturn is. But again, as I said, the management is very different. And now the advantage to Tidewater is the management that put it in bankruptcy that lost $3 billion for investors actually is no longer there. So 2 months ago, they did replace the CEO. So, you know, that would appear as if that's an improved situation. So so that's one of the dynamics. What I would say is that I do think that the offshore oil service industry in general probably is pretty interesting, right? And the reason I say that is, you know, I do think that there's the investment community has been led to believe and has concluded that onshore oil shale is the, you know, most competitive, lowest cost producer that can supply all the world's oil needs. And I think that that's a significantly misunderstood idea. In the meantime, the offshore business has done a lot of the same things that onshore has. And, you know, as I pointed out in one of the slides, right, the business started to slow down at the beginning of 2014, long before the break in the price of oil, because it was not competitive. The costs have gone too high. So the whole cost structure of the industry really has been reset. And in that process, a significant amount of discoveries that were made in the past have been reworked, re-engineered, redesigned with a different lower cost structure, some of which is sustainable, some of which is not. So that's what I think is that offshore oil, there's plenty of opportunities that are economic at clearly the current environment. You know, even a $50, $55 price, there's a lot of projects that are very economic today, especially at a $65 Brent price, they're definitely economic. So I think the activity level, you know, really in the next 6 months dramatically picks up and people start to see that and therefore have a different perception as to the whole offshore oil service business. And there's different ways to play it. Here, I do say I really have a smart capital allocator who will be able to take advantage of and will continue to allocate capital here that will further increase the earnings power of the business. And that's what it really is. And again, he has some of these niches, but it's not only niches, you know, it's also geographic niches. But also there's the potential that he can convince Carlyle to get back on track for where they were earlier, that there's an opportunity at something like a Tidewater or like a Gulfmark that, you know, I think trade at very interesting prices and are very discounted. So therefore deploy capital at low point in the cycle to help consolidate the business. And that could happen. You know, there's a risk that that doesn't happen. So I don't think you can make this investment predicated on you think they'll be the major consolidator, as opposed to there'll be some tuck-in things where he'll allocate capital and get very high rates of return based on what he's doing the next couple of years.
I'm seeing another question from another MOI Global member, which I think is a great follow-up. Very interesting perspective on insiders and their history of shareholder value-driven behavior. Could you please elaborate on insider incentives and if the incentives at this company are potentially structured differently than the incentives of other companies in the industry?
I think that Fabricants, it's actually a great question. So, you know, here in Subsea 7, I'm sure many of you heard me talk about that one, right? So Christian Siem through Siem Industries owns 22% of the company. So the alignment isn't compensation of management, right? Because the last thing you want is to have an incentive compensation for management that you think is going to drive management activity, right? What you really want is a manager who inherently understands capital allocation and is driven to do the right thing. If you want to have a carrot and a stick to make sure he does the right thing, that's more problematic. So therefore, inherently, you want the underlying capital allocator to already be aligned with you and identify that fact and therefore invest with it. Now here with C-Corp, it is interesting because Charles doesn't own nearly as much, but his personal ownership of the business isn't 20% of the company. But I think he definitely thinks about the stock, but I also think he thinks about the reputation and record are an important component of his success and being a manager who will continue to compound and buy and sell assets and therefore not be wedded to a business, but an asset allocator and a capital investor. So I sometimes think people I understand that alignment and that requirement, but I don't think sometimes it isn't driven by just the numbers in the compensation formula.
And I'm seeing another question, which is multiple parts. So let me throw it at you and you can take it however you want to take it. Can you please speak to any spinoff related nuances, any incentives to sandbag the financials, any wrinkles related to insider behavior, perspective on the size of the parent versus spinoff, and any possible non-economic selling?
The spinoff was, he's done spinoffs before, so it's kind of in his DNA and makes sense. The idea that you would have a marine business only if you think you want to consolidate the business, so therefore have a security that would align with someone else. Does the seller have an offshore business and they don't want to own stock in, you know, an inland barge business or a coastwise trade business, which is in the rest of C-Corp Holdings. So therefore, to keep that kind of alignment, to therefore use it as a currency potentially to do acquisitions is one of the reasons. A significant reason for this spinoff also was when they originally entered into the agreement with Carlyle, they specifically had the convert. If they didn't spin it off as a standalone entity, the convert had to be repaid after a year and a half. So the completion of the spinoff guaranteed that the convert stayed outstanding. And since it is far from in the money, there's no way he wanted to return the $175 million. So therefore, completing the spinoff enabled him to fix in and lock in that convert. So therefore, it's not due until 2022. So that's definitely part of the reason. As I also mentioned on the spinoff, right? So now it is a standalone offshore marine boat business, and two other companies in that space are Gulfmark and Tidewater, U.S. listed companies. So therefore, you could see a comp, and that's what I said is that probably drove down C-Corp's valuation also, because you could buy those two companies at, it's officially like book, but the book was restated because they both used fresh start accounting when they went through the bankruptcy reorganizations of those two companies. So the two companies wiped out all the debt they had. They now have cash about equal to what the debt is. So therefore, they're net debt free companies. So therefore, survivability is no longer an issue. And both of those companies traded around 25% of what the historical discounted impaired book value was. So you could buy the assets cheaper. So a number of people called me up, and that's what they did. They were shorting C-Corp Marine as it got spun off, given that differential. There's probably somebody still out there who's got that short on that thinks about, okay, I can buy gold long one at 25 cents in the dollar and short one at 50 cents in the dollar. So, that's part of the spin-off dynamics too in terms of where it's traded down to. I do think that there's a history of people who own C-Corp who, think well of Fabrican and what its record is. So therefore, that does provide some support. That's some of the reason, I think, for the differential in valuation based on book basis between the companies.
And I'm seeing another question from an MOI Global member, which I'd like to read verbatim. How does the order book for new ships look right now? How quick can shipyards ramp up new supply?
Yeah. It's definitely somewhat of an issue. The order book now is really nothing being delivered. So whatever was ordered has been paid and delivered. Orders were canceled. But what that does mean is certain shipyards do have vessels that are somewhere not completed. So therefore, there is a latent opportunity or risk that, you know, as the business starts to improve, new vessels can kind of come out and they'd be available at a pretty significant discount. I actually think that there's, you know, that's part of the equation that makes SeaCor interesting, because I would think that SeaCor Marine would look to do that. Historically, has done that. We'll build assets where you can do it at a significant discount to what the normalized value of it is, whether that's barges in the river system in the U.S., which he's done multiple times, whether that was, you know, if you see on the chart back in late 90s, he built two offshore jackups that you could buy pretty much for steel value, and then therefore before they were completed, flipped them and sold them to somebody. So the idea that, you know, there's a risk, there is some risk to it, but I also think for SeaCor Marine is probably an opportunity in terms of his being able to acquire brand new assets at discounts to what the normalized cost is to do that. And that's what it is in the vessels he recently bought. As I said, you know, to build those vessels, it cost $24 to $25 million for the four of them to be built. Today, you can build them for $17 to $18 million. So you can build it at a 30% discount to what normally it would cost for the replacement value. And so that's an opportunity and a risk, because that means there'll be some vessels that probably will work into the market there, and that will moderate some of the recovery that, you know, I think happens over the next couple of years.
And I think that dovetails to the next question I have from another MLI Global member. She is asking us, or her question is, can you address which of the risk factors from slide number 31 you are most concerned about?
You know, the first thing I'll say about oil, you know, even though I'm thinking that oil is fundamentally strong where it is, and there's a total justification for where the price is, and I think that if anything, over the next several months, it goes higher. I also know from investing in oil markets for the last 45 years that over the next 6 months, I have no idea where the oil price is going to be. So I could well be wrong. Things could happen. So in the short term, there definitely is oil price risk. And therefore, that's a mark-to-market risk of the investment. So, you know, there's a trade down to 35% a book. You know, if oil price declines, that would probably be the case. That said, that's really a more a market risk. You know, the bigger risk really is, you know, the liquidity. And over time, that becomes more of an issue. I do think that Fabricant's conservative in how he's allocated and financed things. And so that's less of a risk. And the timeline on it, given the cash they have, is probably pretty long. You know, and of course, the main component of the debt really is this debt with the Carlyle. It doesn't come due until 2022. So that's a very long window of opportunity. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, the liquidity is an issue that really, can't be handled given the current balance sheet. But over time, that would become more of an issue.
Bob, terrific. Thank you very much. John, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Shai. And Bob, this does conclude the session. Thank you so very much for taking the time to once again share your insights with our members. And I also thank David as well for being a part of this session.
Thank you, David. Yes.
Thank you. And
thank you, Shai.
Just to
I'll leave with one suggestion. If you go onto SeaCor Holdings website, Charles Fabricant writes an annual shareholders letter that's in the fashion of another investor we all admire. And reading all of them, you can get a really great education, both the economics of the boat business, in offshore marine business, and also in capital allocation.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for pointing that out. And lastly, I would just encourage members who are listening to feel free to follow up with Bob and David with their own thoughts and questions. We certainly encourage dialogue within the community. Of course, Shai and I also stand ready to facilitate an introduction if desired. And with that, thank you again. It's been a true pleasure, and we look forward to our next live session, which will take place in about 30 minutes. Until then, goodbye to all.
Thank you. Our pleasure to all. Thank you.
Thank you.